Okay, Philip, welcome. And just like to start with Pitchfork Disney. There's a revival coming on at the Arcola at the end of this month and start of February. Can you talk a bit about how that came about?
Well, there'd been talk of reviving the Pitchfork Disney. It seems to have been going on ever since the first production. So it's been a long 21-year journey, really, to get here. I suppose it kind of kick-started after the revival that Edward Dick, who's directing the Pitchfork Disney this time, Ed did the revival of The Fastest Clock in the Universe
at the
Hampstead Theatre a couple of years ago, which was a really successful production. I was very proud of it, and I thought it was wonderful. And sort of like reinvented the work, really, kind of showed it in a kind of new light, I think, which is what you want, I guess, from a revival. And I remember sort of talking to Ed at the time and saying that it's interesting seeing those early plays now, because a lot of what seemed, I guess, so shocking and different and outrageous and all of those kind of words, you know, at the time.
Controversial,
oh my God, you know, what world is he in? It's a fantasy. All those things that people said at the time. All of that seems to have gone away now. It's like, you know, it's that kind of landscape that I was working around at that time. It doesn't seem so bizarre anymore, I don't think. And I don't mean that in a kind of egotistical sense or anything like that, but it just doesn't. It just feels like what was shocking then isn't shocking now, but in a good way.
Yeah.
Because actually it means that people can see the play for what it is and see the drama, which was thrilling. And that was what was really interesting about rewatching The Fastest Clock, in that, you know, certain things that seem so outrageous and far-fetched, you know, or as if, you know, I remember the comments at the time, like, oh, as if you would get a 30-year-old man being that vain, and, you know, that kind of, as if he would be so obsessed about having a six-pack. What is, you know, there was press comment about, what is all this about a man being obsessed about muscles in his stomach? I've never known a man like that. Of course, you can't throw a brick without hitting a man like that now. So it's kind of, you know, that kind of vocabulary and that kind of world that the play was describing, and sort of like time has caught up with the play, in a way. And I did say to Ed at the time, you know, it'd be really fascinating to see how the Pitchfork Disney sort of like plays now, because so much of that has become almost, you know, in a strange way, has almost become an everyday experience, really. You know, it's kind of, you know, the play's language is now not so extreme. So the journey of it started.
And
there,
also
really,
some of the things that happen on stage are now, if you like, in everybody's living room. I'm thinking, obviously, of Cosmo, one of the characters who comes in, who eats insects for a living in a pub. And obviously that is...
Well, I'm a celebrity, get me out of it. Exactly. People are watching this every night. You know, I mean, a scene like that won't bother my nephews in the least. Yeah. You know, they won't bat an eyelid.
And even the image of the snake being fried, you know, that seems to be now so much less, you know.
Well, I mean, we've got this kind of, you know, the YouTube culture, which, you know, this kind of, this obsession with atrocity. I mean, we were talking about this in the rehearsal room a little while ago, where Cosmo gives his kind of mission statement for life. There's a moment in the play, he has this monologue where he gives, you know, this is the way that I see the world. Yeah. And, you know, he comes out with this, I'm paraphrasing, but he comes out with this line that says, you know, Darwin got it all wrong.
Yeah.
It's not survival of the fittest, it's survival of the sickest.
Yeah.
Which seems to me to, you know, sum up a lot of that. If you go on those websites that have clips, you know, the most popular clips are, you know, see a ball getting its head chopped off, you know, see a kitten getting fed to piranhas, you know, which seems to me like, you know, the world of Cosmo Disney has come to life.
Yeah.
So, yeah, a lot of that is very interesting now. I mean, it's also the thing, just, you know, just quickly in sort of parenthesis to that, really, but this the language that the Pitchfork Disney has, where you know, it doesn't make it easy for the audience. It doesn't tell you up front what is real and what is not real.
Yeah.
And you have these characters that are, you know, in a very theatrical sense, creating the world around them with words, and it takes you a while to realise that every word they're saying is a complete lie.
Yeah.
You know? So they're living in a kind of a manufactured world, which is their safety net about how they have to live. Now that seemed, you know, when the play was first done, you know, definitely looking back on some of the early comment, that seemed something that people couldn't get their head around. Yeah. It's like they, you know, they were obviously trusting theatre far too much, you know. Yeah. And the characters are lying through their teeth. Now that in itself is nothing new, obviously, but perhaps the extremes to which it was pushed, people found it difficult. But of course now you've got kind of young people playing computer games and living alternate lives every night of the week. They're in another world. They've got avatars, they've got different names, different back histories. They create them in an instant. You know, I've got friends that have created 3 or 4 different personalities. Everyone's got different names on their internet or on their email. They can respond to all these different identities. There's no problem with that at all. We are all a million different people. And I think Pitchfork was beginning to explore all of that, about the way we create our own reality, you know.
Yeah, and basically it's about Presley and Haley, brother and sister, who've at some point probably have lost their parents, I think that's safe to say.
Yeah.
And their fantasies about their life together, they're obviously frightened of the world and have this feeling that they're vulnerable and threatened, but they transmute that into this storytelling which rationalizes the outside world as a kind of post-apocalyptic landscape and so on. Have you rewritten it at all now?
No, I mean, basically it's kind of, with the exception of a few of the little, you know, tidy ups that I wanted to put in, having seen other productions that were happening around about the time, being, you know, bear in mind that there's a new edition of the collected plays that contain that Fast Clock in the Universe and Ghost from a Perfect Place coming out, and that hasn't been in print for a long time. That's been out of print about 5 or 6 years. So there's been a few productions that have happened where I've kind of managed to kind of tidy up one. But basically, no, it's the same thing. I mean, that's how Pitchfork Disney sort of like came about. Really, was. Looking back, I can see that I started to write it while I was still a student at St. Martin's, and what I was doing then was, part of my painting course, part of my work that I was doing there was performance art, and the performance art was me going into galleries and doing very, very long monologues, doing character studies. Sometimes they had a narrative, sometimes they had a story, or sometimes they were just riffs on one kind of idea. And part of that was that I was creating a sequence of characters that would shift really between 3 or 4 identities, and you would think that they were becoming different people, but actually they were all the same person, but living within their different recreations of the world around them. So you would get the same story as such, but told 3 or 4 different ways. So that kind of, that very con, not very conscious, I don't mean in that sense, but quite clearly that sort of fed in to the language of the Pitchfork Disney. And what I did, I guess, was just push it further than I'd ever pushed it before, because you've got these two, this brother and sister who are 28 years old in the Pitchfork Disney, and we know that something terrible happened in their lives 10 years ago, just when they were on the brink of real adulthood at the age of 18. Something terrible happened to them, and happened to them in the sense that it took their parents away.
Yeah.
Their parents were, you know, taken out of their lives, and, you know, one assumes by some kind of act of violence in some way. And it becomes an impossible landscape, it becomes an impossible world for them to live in. Their curse is that they're highly intelligent. They have kind of, in a kind of existential way, I guess, they've sunk into a world trying to make sense of that moment. And the making sense of that moment is the culmination of the play. That in a way, the play is the outcome. That the only way they can make sense of it is to reinvent the world as somewhere that's safe. And the way they do that is to say, well, if people can be unkind and do what happened to mum and dad, then we will get rid of everyone. We will, in our minds, we will have a nuclear holocaust, and we will destroy the world. The other phrase that I've used now and again, and it's something I've talked about in rehearsals a lot, is image architecture, which is the way that you can take the play, if you kind of take away the kind of the machinery of the play, if you like, the way that certain clusters of words, images, shapes mutate and riff and change like a piece of jazz through the play. And That's not something that an audience member has to kind of consciously, in fact you don't want them to obviously consciously know that. You know, Hayley and Presley, I think, feel that their kind of childhood has been completely destroyed because of this event that happened just when they were on the brink of leaving their childhood. You know, it's like, you know, what is your life?
But they're
about?
Also tense about their sexuality individually.
Well, they're locked together in one room. Yeah. You know, one gets the feeling that they've not had relationships with anyone else. No. They've kind of suppressed their sexuality because of the fear of the outside. Yeah. So yeah, I mean that kind of ripples that kind of ripples through. Also, just as a kind of sidebar kind of comment on that, it's also, you know, this kind of persistent words of destruction and decay and kind of things falling to pieces. And, you know, that kind of creates a kind of an emotional temperature, really.
Yeah. Childhood, you mentioned there. It seems in your work in general that it's a place both of terrors and a place of refuge. You know, quite often characters either long for their childhood or return to it or return to their youth, you know. Is that something that you've developed consciously, or?
Well, I don't think the themes like that, I mean, are developed consciously at all, really. I wasn't really aware of that. In fact, a lot of the things that are in my work, I'm completely unaware of, to the extent that, you know, I think, you know, recently in the past 3 or 4 years, I've done a couple of stage plays that I thought were unlike anything I've ever done before, you know. And I was saying to mates of mine, wait, I think you'll be interested in this. It's completely unlike me, you know. And then they kind of say, oh, God, they come to see it. And it's, oh, God, I knew it was you within the first 2 minutes. It's like, you know, it's all your usual kind of bump in it. And so I'm not kind of aware of that. I guess the childhood thing is something that's always been there, really. I mean, my own childhood was a very, you know, as it is for all of us, you know, a cross between, you know, living with, you know, in the world of Mary Poppins and the world of Hannibal Lecter at the same time. You know, you're kind of going between these two things. And I think it probably comes from the fact that, you know, I was very ill as a child, very sick, you know, it was chronic. I still suffer from asthma, but I was chronically asthmatic as a child. So my body was very weak. I couldn't run. I couldn't mix with other people. I couldn't, you know, I didn't really have friends as such as a normal young boy would. And that didn't happen until I started to get into my teens, really. And I think that does sort of like cut you off from the world and make you see things, you know, slightly different.
Pushes you towards reading, towards...
an interior life.
Yeah.
Yeah, pushes you towards an interior life, yeah.
With Pitchfork Disney, this revival... Cosmo is played by Nathan Stewart Jarrett. What was it?
Misfits, yeah.
That's right. I think he's the one who can turn back time, which I thought was a lovely coincidence. He's a black actor.
Yeah.
Could you talk a bit about that? Because I think it's almost unique, and I've always been frustrated how few revivals of contemporary classic plays do that with the racial mix, basically. Whereas, you know, you've written these characters, they could be from almost any background.
Absolutely, yeah.
And it's so rarely done.
Well, we did it in the revival of The Fastest Clock as well, you know. You just cast the best people for the parts. It's as simple as that. I mean, I think in most of the plays that I've done, it's irrelevant what ethnic mix you have on stage, really. I mean, the drama is the drama. And, you know, unless something like that becomes a real plot point, you know, something that you have to kind of make some kind of visual reference to, I think it's, you know, for me, it's just whoever's the best casting is what you go with. There shouldn't be any decision otherwise.
But on the other hand, it also adds another layer, doesn't it, to Cosmo's sort of arrival.
It does, and it kind of, it's a way of kind of... reinventing the wheel with something, and sometimes just seeing what that does, you know, just seeing how kind of, you know, what new ideas it might bring into the interpretation of the thing. I mean, I wouldn't do it, you know, ever just for the sake of doing it. The first decision is that it's the best actor for the role, and then you take it from there, really.
Let's talk about Shivered, which is your new play this year, coming up in April.
Yeah.
Could you say something about that, sort of the plot situation or the characters? Is it like Tender Napalm or is it like Mercury Fur?
Is it a third limb that's opening? It's kind of, I think it opens in March, actually. I'm not quite sure. I think so. I'm so date-addled at the moment.
Yeah, actually, I've written here March.
March, there we go.
I write March and I say April.
There you go. I'm always petrified about saying something about a play before it's opened. Mm. The way Shivered started to come about was that I was working on the story of a family, and this has been going on for quite a while. It's a play that's kind of been that I started, then put to one side, and then did something else, and then I came back to it. And I wanted to tell this story of a family over almost like the first. What was beginning to take shape as the first decade of the new millennium, really, to cover that kind of 10 or 11 year period in which he says portentously the kind of 21st century starts to take shape. You know, it starts to have a colour of what it's all about. And it was quite, you know, it interested me in a way to do that. I was kind of creating this family that had moved out into a kind of a fictitious new town in Essex, which I'm calling Drailingstow, and I put them going there because a new car plant had just opened when times were good at the beginning of the millennium, and things are, you know, and there's a wonderful sort of like green mound beside a motorway that people go to, and I like that because it kind of had echoes of sort of like the green hills of England and all of that. But then something started to happen that scared me and excited me in equal measure, in that I liked what I was doing but found it was telling a more interesting story when I started to break the narrative. And I thought, yes, there's chronology is only one way to tell a story, you know, chronologically is only one way to tell a story, and there's another story waiting to be told here, which is to really deconstruct the whole story and just present these little fragments of it and leave huge gaps between each fragment, but then rearrange the fragments so that they tell another story. So you have in your mind, you can work out what the story chronologically is, but I've given another story telling a different set of things by rearranging. So that's the essence of it, really, in a nutshell.
And is it just one family or two families?
It touches on two families that come together. There's the main family, if you like, which is mother, father, and their two children, their two boys. And then there's one other family, which is just a mother and her son. And the younger son makes friends with the younger son of the other family. So they're linked by a friendship of these two boys. And it kind of tells their story over this, what I think is a kind of 12-year period. So it's the first time I've done a kind of saga in that way.
Exactly.
I mean, you see a child grow up. You see the scene in which he's born, and then you see him, you know, kind of like as a grown up, well, as a child anyway, kind of 12-year-old, 13-year-old. So that's exciting. Yeah.
And have you cast that already?
We're in the process of casting now.
Right now,
which is really exciting. I always love that process of when actors start to say the lines, and you know, you think, thank Christ, if they can actually say them without bursting out laughing. You know?
Right. And how did it feel to be working simultaneously on your first play and your latest?
Well, it wasn't planned. Yeah, it really wasn't planned. It wasn't meant to be like this. But it's a kind of, I suppose it's a kind of interesting coincidence. It's a bit kind of full on. It's a bit like trying to do synchronized swimming in a tsunami. You know, it's kind of, you're trying to get these decisions made and everything's kind of like coming at you at full blast. And yet the idea of, you know, working on the very first thing I did and also working on the most recent thing I have done is, yeah, that's kind of that, you know, that way madness lies, really. Kind of, it's very odd.
You've got a really busy year, because I think there's tour, is that right, of Tender Napalm
being organised? I hope so, yeah. That looks like on the cards. I think people are talking about a tour of Tender Napalm and then coming back to Southwark, yeah.
And also Mercury Fur?
I believe Mercury Fur is going to be at the Old Red Lion, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And when will that be?
Tour kind of like springtime, if that comes together, and I believe the Old Red Lion, Mercury Fur, sort of like March, April, something like that, April, I think, yeah.
You have been in the past, talking of Mercury Fur, misunderstood by critics, and I think we've spoken about this before.
Yeah.
At the very beginning, it was because you were coming to theatre from an art school background.
Yeah.
Can you sort of talk a little bit about that? I mean, what was it like when you had the Pitchfork Disney first on and you had people saying, what is this?
Or who does he think he is? Which was like more, you know. I had this running joke with a lot of my mates who were, you know, working with me at that time, that for about a 10-year period, I was turned. I was turned everything. What I mean by that was, I was always playwright, a painter turned playwright. I was always something else. I was never ever referred to as a playwright.
Filmmaker
turned playwright. I was always something else, you know, and that was very depressing. Not depressing. I mean, I can understand why it was happening, but I just felt they were so reluctant to actually just say I'm a playwright that it always had to give the impression that I was butterflying from thing to thing, and that I was kind of just playing around with writing plays, and I wasn't serious about it because basically I was a filmmaker turned playwright or a painter turned playwright. So that was kind of, I mean, that doesn't exist anymore. I mean, that's tend to have disappeared completely.
Yeah,
but for most of the 90s. That's what I had. So that was kind of very odd. The other thing, you know, this whole kind of, and you're right, you and I have talked about this many times, this whole kind of thing of the people latching on to the atrocity exhibition, if you like, in the work. You know, that's kind of really bizarre, because if we go back a little bit to, say, the 80s, I showed my first drawing at the Institute of Contemporary Arts in 1981, and from 1981 to 1991, which is when Pitchfork Disney happened, I was really mainly known just as a visual artist, you know. And if you look at a lot of the comment about the visual art, the words that were kind of related to me were whimsical and beguiling and magical, and, you know, there were all these kind of words, like I was suddenly, you know, I'd suddenly, you know, I was, you know, Puck incarnate, you know, in these art galleries. So there was all of that going on. Suddenly, I kind of do the Pitchfork Disney, and there was a whole new vocabulary that came along, which was kind of like, you know, shocking, you know, outrageous,
provocative,
you know. Yeah. Now, all might be true, but it was interesting that, in a way, I didn't think I was doing anything that was more shocking or provocative in the Pitchfork Disney than I had been doing in the art world for 10 years.
Yeah.
But suddenly you kind of translate that into the world of theatre, and it was becoming, you know, shocking. So that was very odd. I mean, I suppose the most shocking, the play that's received the most controversy in that is Mercury Fur.
Yes.
Which I still am very upset about, that it was ever... the critical press reacted to it in that way, because if you look at the press comment at the time, it seems to be completely disengaged from the experience of actually seeing the play. You know, I mean, we had audiences coming along to see that play that were deeply moved, that were in tears by the end, that felt a lot. Yes, they were shocked by moments, but they didn't feel it was a nihilistic experience. They felt it was a very, you know, a moving and life-enhancing experience, one hopes, he says, you know, a bit portentously, but you know what I mean. It's and I think that's the only criteria by which you kind of judge an artwork. I mean, we're still completely wrapped up, particularly in theatre in this country, in this kind of moralistic agenda. It's almost like a kind of Victorian attitude to painting. That you have, what's your story? Has he got a moral agenda? The surprised wife, because she's betraying her husband, and guilt, you know, all of these kind of Victorian images of morality. And morality like that doesn't exist in an artwork. I mean, it's not, morality is not connected to subject matter. It's completely devoid of subject matter. You can write about anything, you can do anything. The only morality is, does it leave an audience going back into their life with with more passion, more intensity, more love? Are they feeling love with more wildness, with more daring? If they do that, then that's what it's about. There's no other criteria on which to judge it.
Yeah. On the other hand, you have to admit, I'm sure, that there are some audience members, you know, your work is not for them. I have been in the theatre, not even on a press night, where some people have walked out.
Yeah,
they obviously thought it was too intense, maybe too graphic, maybe linguistically too wild, to use your word. You know, so you have to admit that, surely. It's not for everybody, is it, really?
No, but you know, but most, you know, most things that are coming, you know, what am I trying to say here? What am I gabbling on about? It's... You know, I'm not producing hamburgers. You know, I'm not doing the least offensive taste to please the most number of people. You know, I mean, that's the thing. It's kind of, you need to kind of work out, I'm trying to be true to what I think I should be doing and what I think theatre is. And I'm trying to do that as honestly and as truthfully and with as much inventiveness as I can. Now, if you're, the other side of the equation that you've just said to me is, you must know what you need to do to get into the West End and have a 9-month run. Well, of course I do. I mean, yeah, of course I do. You know, I know what I need. I know those things that I need to wheedle out of the work and what I need to put in to make it a more mainstream success.
Yeah.
And I've had advice on that, you know, for the past 21 years. Oh, if only. Yeah, if only you could not do that. If only you didn't mention that. You know, it's kind of...
If only they were nice Cockneys.
If only they were chirping. If only there was an ABBA song at the end. You could be in the West End for months. You know, so I've had advice about that, you know. But that's not the work I'm doing. You know, I couldn't do that. You know, to sustain yourself through writing a play, getting actors on board, going through the production, you have to have such passion and belief in it. It has to mean everything to you. Otherwise, you would crumble. You couldn't get through it. Also, I've always said to, you know, any bunch of actors that I've worked with, you know, I usually say to them, look, what inspires and excites us would inspire and excite an audience. And if we're not excited by it, then we can't have a hope in hell of exciting anyone else.
Yeah.
So it's just do what you believe in and do it with every atom of you. And then those people that are meant to kind of, you know, react to it will react to it and they'll get something back. But some people won't. It's like falling in love. I mean, we can't fancy everyone. We're not meant to fancy everyone. We're just meant to fancy those people we want to procreate with. That's what it's all about. So, you know, yes, I think I've come.
Thank you very much, Philip.
Thank you.
Thank you.